It is unattended, and it's floating out there at sea with nobody on board, no lights, no power.
The Coast Guard monitors a derelict fishing vessel in U.S. waters off Alaska's coast. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 3rd. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, lawmakers get into the details over the oil tax debate.
But frankly, if you want to increase oil production, you want to go where the oil is. Most of the oil is sitting in Prudhoe Bay.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Association of Alaska School Boards promotes one-to-one digital learning for all Alaska students to prepare them for success in the global economy. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
Invited panelists spoke out against a new national oceans policy at a congressional subcommittee hearing in Anchorage this morning. Congressman Don Young chaired the subcommittee on fisheries, wildlife, oceans, and insular affairs oversight hearing, with Senator Lisa Murkowski sitting beside him on the dais as an invited guest. Don Young called the new version of the oceans policy too complicated while criticizing the Obama administration's disregard for stakeholder involvement.
Now, without statutory authorization, the administration has decided to create a new, vague regulatory bureaucracy through the executive order.
Young pointed to a provision for a coastal marine spatial planning initiative as the most troubling, saying it would establish 9 regional planning bodies composed of federal agencies that would authorize coastal zone planning.
The reach of this ocean policy will stretch throughout the entire state and affect almost all activity that requires a federal permit.
Young said the oceans policy could create a new layer of fisheries regulation topping that of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. Representatives from Alaska's development interests, fishing, mining, oil, and gas, and from the state administration and the legislature panned the new legislation. Commentators, including State Representative Reggie Jewell, a Democrat from Kotzebue, said the legislation would add an additional thicket of regulation to existing state and federal permitting regimes while creating potential legal blocks to proposed development projects. Doug Vincent Lang spoke for the State Department of Fish and Game. He said the oceans policy federalizes the decision process and embeds authority in regional boards dominated by federal agencies.
Alaska's marine and coastal resources and their uses are already tightly regulated by a vast and diverse array of federal, state, and local authorities. We do not believe additional federal regulatory oversight is needed.
Senator Murkowski said the oceans policy is an attempt by the federal government to challenge states' rights.
I think we recognize that this is yet another attempt by the executive branch to tell us how we can and how we cannot use our oceans and our coasts.
Murkowski said one-size-fits-all standards rarely work for Alaska. The sole defender of the oceans legislation at the meeting was Dr. John Farrell, executive director of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. Farrell commented only in the context of the Arctic Research Commission's recommendations submitted to the Arctic portion of the draft implementation plan for the National Ocean Policy.
And the 5 actions that we proposed, we think, are very beneficial to not only the state, but the public and the private sectors. It would help make sure there's safe shipping. It would help industry better understand environmental changes and so on. So we think the Arctic component is certainly beneficial private and public interests.
Congressman Young cautioned that the oceans policy legislation, which has been under development for the past 2 years, creates additional federal oversight panels which could reach far inland. The Obama administration's national ocean policy calls for a new ocean zoning authority headed by 9 federally dominated regional planning bodies which will have no representation by the communities and businesses that will actually be impacted by their regulations. Young said the administration refuses to tell Congress how much money it will be diverting from other uses to fund this new policy. The The Coast Guard is monitoring a derelict vessel in U.S. waters off Alaska's coast that washed out to sea during the tsunami that struck the coast of Japan a year ago. The vessel is drifting in a busy shipping area 170 miles from southeast Alaska in the Gulf of Alaska, APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The white fishing vessel named Ruun Maru is between 150 and 200 feet long. Petty Officer David Mosley says it was used for catching squid.
It is unattended and it's floating out there at sea with nobody on board, no lights, no power. And so it's very much a concern for us because it's in shipping lanes. It's where commercial vessels go through all the time. So we're very much concerned about the safety of the mariners who are utilizing the Gulf of Alaska to make their living.
The Coast Guard began monitoring the vessel when it entered U.S. waters on Saturday. Mosley says since then, crews from Kodiak have made regular flights to the ship to drop data marker buoys nearby.
It's a buoy that sends off a radio signal that we can track. We drop that into the water next to the vessel to get an idea of where it might be drifting.
The ship is currently heading north-northwest, essentially paralleling the coast.
The Coast Guard is conducting what we call broadcast notice to mariners. They're radio transmissions, updates of the position of the vessel, asking commercial tankers, cargo ships, even other fishing vessels to use caution in the area and to avoid the ship.
The Coast Guard is working with other federal and state agencies to decide what to do with the ship. The options are to sink it at sea or tow it to shore for disposal. It's not clear if the ship is still carrying any fuel on board. Petty Officer Mosley says the Coast Guard deals with derelict ships from time to time, but this case is unique.
This is the first piece of debris from the tsunami, the first vessel from that incident that we've had to address.
And is it surprising that it survived so much intact?
I don't even know how to answer that. I've been at sea I've been in the Coast Guard for 13 years. Very little surprises me anymore. The sea's a very dynamic place. Things that you think would happen one way often happen another.
Because the ship is so far out to sea, Mosley says there's a several-day window for deciding what to do with it. But he says the Coast Guard would like to take action quickly. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Anchorage Police Chief Mark Mew announced yesterday that a forensic dive team has discovered what investigators believe to be the body of Samantha Koenig. He made the announcement at Anchorage Police Department headquarters late Monday. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
APD Chief Mark Mew says after weeks of searching, investigators have found what they believe to be Samantha Koenig's body in Matanuska Lake.
Investigators believe that Samantha died within hours of abduction.
The person responsible for Samantha's death acted alone.
And we're confident we have that person in custody.
The 18-year-old barista disappeared from the Anchorage coffee stand where she worked on February 1st. Security video showed her being led away from the stand by an armed man. The FBI partnered with the APD on the investigation. Special Agent in Charge Mary Rook says the case was perplexing.
Investigators found no direct association between the abductor and Samantha or any member of her family. I believe it was largely the dissociative nature of this crime that so perplexed investigators, at least initially.
Chief Mew says the Office of the State Medical Examiner will soon conduct a thorough examination of the body to verify the identity, that the APD and the FBI are working closely with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and that charges for Koenig's murder and kidnapping will be forthcoming. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new co-op gets ready to open in Fairbanks.
As much as possible, if there's a local source, we're going to include a lot of locally produced foods.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
A Fairbanks woman has been charged with submitting fraudulent signatures for the Alaska Coastal Management Program Initiative. Deborah A. Carroll faces 5 felony and misdemeanor charges, including forgery, unsworn falsification, and perjury. Juneau Mayor Bruce Patello is chairman of the Alaska Sea Party, the group behind the Coastal Management Initiative. He says group officials noticed the forgeries the night before submitting their petition books to the State Division of Elections.
It was quite evident, just as a layperson looking through, that the signatures, the handwriting throughout, looked suspiciously similar, so we withheld it. The following week, I delivered this booklet to the Office of Special Prosecutions, and they in turn delivered it to the state troopers for an investigation that resulted in a criminal complaint.
The charges were originally announced by Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell's office, which erroneously had said Carroll was hired by the Sea Party. Patello says the group did not have a direct relationship with Carroll. She was employed by consultant Scott Kohlhaas, who organized much of the group's signature gathering effort in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Mat-Su. Patello says one isolated incident should not diminish the efforts of dozens of volunteers who collected nearly 30,000 valid signatures in less than a month to put the Coastal Management Initiative on this year's ballot.
Throughout the process, I frankly had expected that our signature gatherers would bring integrity to the process, and 99.5% of them did.
Carroll is scheduled to be arraigned in Fairbanks on Friday, April 13th. Before closing last year, the Alaska Coastal Management Program gave local communities greater input into development on federal land in their backyards. It also streamlined the permitting activities of various state and federal agencies. Legislation introduced this year to reauthorize the program with similar language to the initiative appears unlikely to pass. An oil tax bill is finally on the table in the Senate Finance Committee. The committee today released a draft of its rewrite of the bill the Resources Committee passed to them nearly a month ago. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The bill has had 18 hearings with input from consultants, the oil and gas industry, the Parnell administration, and the public. Committee Chairman Bert Stedman, a Republican from Sitka, says he anticipates having a few remaining issues quickly worked out and ready for a floor vote by this weekend. Stedman has scheduled one more hearing from the oil industry, but he says he expects they're going to recognize the bill as significant.
This goes to the core of the structure of our oil taxes and addresses some of the bigger concerns that have been pointed out by our consultants. And some of these issues were never even addressed or focused on in either the House version or the governor's bill.
The structural change, Stedman refers to, is the base of what's taxed. The new tax regime would hinge on the gross value of production, basically the market price of oil minus the state's royalty. Rate increases will be calculated from that point.
And that would be on the gross value before the deductions of expenditures, which helps solve some embedded problems we have in our oil tax structure. We have an exposure now, very high oil prices, where the state and federal government could offset a lot of the capital expenditure costs in excess of 100%. By making this non-deductible, that would bring that down to a level of probably in about 65.
Among other changes in the bill is a removal of all references to what's called decoupling, the statutory link between oil taxes and gas taxes. The new gross value structure means the state would never have to reimburse companies when there were price discrepancies. In another change, the tax rate would increase until oil sells for $125 a barrel. At that point, the rate remains more or less constant. Stedman says there's one more major issue still pending: what sort of incentives it will take to increase production in the Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk fields.
Because quite frankly, if you want to increase oil production, you want to go where the oil is, and most of the oil is sitting in Prudhoe Bay, and Kuparuk would be next. So that is an area that we couldn't quite get our hands around yet, and those discussions are underway.
The House is prepared to deal with the bill once it's finished. Schedules already include hearings on the measure. However, considering that delivery is expected less than a week before adjournment, members are not committing to getting through in time. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A bill that would allow judges to consider FASD as a mitigating factor in criminal sentencing had a hearing in the Senate Finance Committee yesterday. FASD stands for Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders. It refers to the range of conditions experienced by children whose mothers drank alcohol while pregnant. Many of the disorders can impair brain function, including how the person with FASD uses judgment and processes information. Senate Bill 151 gives judges the option of considering FASD as a mitigating factor if it's clear the defendant's condition significantly affected their conduct. But Anchorage Republican Kevin Meyer, the bill's sponsor, says it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card for people with FASD.
What we see is a lot of times folks who suffer from this, a lot of times we end up throwing them in our correction system, and then that becomes their way of life. What we're saying is that, hey, maybe a long jail sentence for some of the crimes isn't the right thing to help these folks.
Meyer says the bill helps accomplish what Alaska Supreme Court Chief Justice Walter Carpinetti and other legal experts have told lawmakers about the need for more flexibility in the state's legal system. The Senate Finance Committee held the bill for another hearing. Alaska U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich recently wrote to Indian Health Service Director Dr. Yvette Robidoux asking why the agency isn't meeting its obligation to pay the full costs of running health clinics in rural Alaska. From member station KNBA, Jacqueline Estes reports.
According to its 2013 justification for appropriations, the Indian Health Service, or IHS, leases 166 so-called village-built clinics. Tribal health organizations and tribes own most of these clinics, and local governments own a handful. Carolyn Crowder is health director for the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association. She says clinic owners are in a tough predicament.
The village-built clinics have been in a crisis situation in the state of Alaska for a number of years, primarily due to underfunding by the Indian Health Services.
Crowder says when Congress created the Community Health Aid Program in the 1960s, rather than building clinics it would then own, the IHS leased existing facilities. She says the problem is the IHS funds the clinics at 1989 levels, paying only part of the actual cost of running them.
The issue is that the village-built leases that were initiated way back in the 80s have not kept up with the cost of operations and the new standards and the staffing requirements for the clinic leases. So the amount of funds that are available to help support the operations for the clinics is now roughly about 55 to 60% on average across the state.
Crowder says in 2011, tribal health organizations put together a report for the IHS and for Congress explaining the problem and asking for relief.
At that time, I believe it was $5.5 million was a shortfall for the leases to bring them up to par to meet basic operating expenses, and not even including replacement costs, so no depreciation expense or anything related to that in that estimate. This is purely and strictly for just operating costs of the clinics. That has gone nowhere, quite frankly.
Crowder says the gap between what IHS is paying and actual costs now is $6.5 million. Typically, a property owner would end a lease that doesn't cover costs, but Crowder says clinic owners are reluctant to do that.
Because these are such critical facilities for the community, I don't think anyone's willing to say they're going to shut the doors.
She says many of the buildings weren't designed to be clinics and are small, old, and substandard. She says owners run the buildings, in some cases using money that could go to patient care, but she says that's becoming more difficult as owners struggle with rising costs, particularly the high cost of electricity and fuel for heating.
There have been cases where clinics have had to shut down hours. There have been cases where clinics have had to They've run out of fuel and pipes have frozen and medicine has frozen, and it creates a whole huge issue. We have been trying to get the severity of this issue to the attention of the IHS to take some action. And it has proven to be a very difficult process. Partly, I view it as out of sight, out of mind.
Village-built leases are unique to Alaska. A 2001 Alaska Tribal Health Director's report on the Community Health Aid Program says IHS is paying $7 per square foot for village clinic space, compared to $17 to $20 per square foot for leases in the lower 48. Spokesperson Christine Witterland says the Indian Health Service is reviewing the letter from the senators and will respond to them. She emailed that IHS is working with Alaska Native leaders on the issue. I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by Ace Air. Ace Air Cargo now offering passenger service to Dutch Harbor 6 days a week. Information and reservations at aceaircargo.com.
The Sitka Sound Sacro herring fishery will stand down until Thursday in order to give processors time to catch up with the incoming catch. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game estimates fishermen caught roughly 5,600 tons of fish during the second opening on Monday. That brings the total harvest so far to more than a third of this year's guideline harvest level. The herring must be caught before they deposit their eggs. ADF&G management biologist Dave Gordon says the timing of the fishery is always a concern.
Certainly this year we're finding ourselves behind the curve on the spawn, so it's definitely of great concern. That means the fish are putting their eggs on the beach, and so there's a significant portion of the stock that's not going to be available for potential harvest.
Aerial surveys took place Tuesday to continue monitoring the distribution of the fish and the progression of the spawn. The next vessel survey is slated for tomorrow. A former downtown Fairbanks supermarket is scheduled for renovation this spring. The building will become the home of a new co-op specializing in fresh, locally grown and organic foods. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
After years of fundraising and planning, work is finally about to begin on the Fairbanks Community Cooperative Market. A growing group of area residents have been talking about opening a co-op market since 2006, and work on this venture has been steadily moving ahead since 2009. Project manager Mary Christensen says the co-op board of directors will consider a financing plan in a couple of weeks, and if all goes well, work on renovating about 6,000 square feet of space in the McKinley Building on Gaffney Road will begin in about a month. The building is the former home of the Alaska Marketplace, but longtime residents may remember the structure by another name, the old Foodland Building. Christensen says the co-op market is scheduled to open in the fall, just in time to offer produce harvested from around the interior, along with fresh seafood and meat products from elsewhere in Alaska.
As much as possible, if there's a local source, we're going to include a lot of locally produced foods. When they're not available, we will get our food from somewhere else, because we're going to have a full grocery store.
That includes other wares that would be found in larger grocery stores, such as health products. Christensen says it won't be possible to offer locally grown products year-round, but what's not local will still be fresh.
When we bring in produce from the lower 48, it's going to be really good produce, high-quality fruit. We're going to have a really high standard for the quality.
Hans Geyer, a member of the co-op board and an area farmer, says the reason for the emphasis on locally grown is obvious.
Well, local
photo tastes better because it's fresher.
Geyer is a former UAF economist and cooperative extension outreach manager, and he says there are other benefits for a business that specializes in locally grown food.
It means that money is staying in the state and in the community. I mean, when you buy something at the co-op that's produced in the state, that means all the money goes to producers, to the retailer, and to yourself if you're working for the co-op.
Christensen says anyone will be able to shop at the co-op, but co-op members will get additional benefits.
Throughout the store, there will be member-only rewards, specials on different items every week, and then there will be 4 to 6 periods every year when the member owner gets a discount.
Christensen says once the co-op begins generating a profit, members also will get a portion of those earnings back. She says the co-op had signed up nearly 1,300 members as of last week. Organizers hope to boost that number to at least 1,500 by the time the co-op opens in the fall. Membership costs $200. Earnings from the membership fees constitute a big chunk of the money that's in the financing plan that will go before the co-op board, along with a $300,000 low-interest federal loan and a contribution from Golden Valley Electric Association and a commercial loan. Christensen says it'll be tough to compete against the big nationwide grocery chains, but she says the board is determined to offer products at a competitive price.
There are going to be lots of ways for us to keep our prices competitive, and one of our goals is to access all the tools for doing that. There's ways to get, you know, good discounts and to pass discounts on to the consumer, and we're going to aggressively pursue those methods.
You can find out more by going to fairbankscoop.org. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Parties on both sides of the Fairbanks teacher contract dispute will likely employ a private mediator to jumpstart stalled negotiations and expedite a resolution. Negotiating teams for teachers and the district reached an impasse last week and announced plans to go to mediation. North Star Borough School District Labor Relations Director Gail Pierce says a federal mediator is the normal go-to.
Ordinarily, the mediator comes from the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, but that person is not available until May 3rd and 4th, and so the parties are working together to try to identify somebody who can be here more quickly.
The district and teachers' union negotiating teams have gone back and forth for nearly a year and a half trying to come to agreement on a cost of living increase, personal leave, and other issues. Fairbanks Education Association President Tammy Smith says both parties want to agree on a new contract before the end of the school year next month.
We don't settle a contract over the summer because our membership is gone over the summer, so we can't really vote over the course of the summer. So the timeline certainly is the end of the school year.
If mediation fails, the next step is arbitration, in which an independent third party recommends a resolution. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Kristen Spack is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers home choice seminars that provide tools for making informed decisions about purchasing and financing a home and loans tailored for first-time home buyers. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.